today we're going to talk a little bit about Sfiras HaOmer. As we know, every year on the second night of Pesach, we begin the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. And just by way of introduction, something that really made me think a lot this year, as we were counting Sfira over the first days of Pesach and throughout Chol HaMoed, I thought very much about the comment that Rav Soloveitchik writes when he tries to frame the whole mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. Rav Soloveitchik has in one of his English essays about the significance that halacha places on counting. I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to make a source sheet for today. It's been a busy Yom Tov. So Rav Soloveitchik talks about the following. He says that if you look throughout the Psukim and Chumash, you will find that very often we are instructed to be involved in a count. He said there are times when we count days, there are times when we count weeks, there are times when we count years, and there are times when we count Shemitos, which leads up to the Jubilee year, to Yovel. So he says when it comes to Shavuos, as we know, we have 49-day count. When it comes to 7 years, we have to count until we get to Shemitah. We count 7 Shemitos and we get to a Yovel. Not only do we find it by this aspect of life, but he says we find it also by Tumah and Tahara. As we know, there's the concept of Shiva Nikiyim, that a woman has to count 7 clean days until she is able to go to the mikvah. As we know, when it comes to, unfortunately, Yimei Avel as well, when people are in a state of mourning, so we know that, God forbid, at that point also, we have a count of Shiva, then we have a count of Shloshim, and we have a count of Yud Beis Chodesh. And Rav Soloveitchik points out that you'll notice, that counting seems to play a major role in Jewish religious life. And the question is, why? Why do we have so many mitzvahs in which we have an obligation to count? And he explains, the reason why is because whenever one is engaged in a count, that means, obviously, that you believe that if tonight is day 32, then that means yesterday was day 31, and it means you believe that tomorrow is going to be day 33, and so on and so forth. And he said, this is really what the religious experience is all about, that a person needs to understand the context of time, that not only do we live in the present, and we live in the time that we have the opportunity to be alive in, but he said we always live in the context of all that came before us, and we have a pledge that we will also live and bring the greatest life that we can to the future that will come out of us. And he suggests that there's no greater way for us to come to an appreciation of Shavuos, which is the time of year when we celebrate how much the Torah means to us, Zman Matan Torah Seinu, than to make sure that we have an understanding and a background of what time means to us, about the Mesorah that we have that came before us, that it comes all the way from Moshe Rabbeinu, and that we pledge to push the Mesorah forward. And therefore, he says, it is highly appropriate that as we come to celebrate the Yom Tov of Shavuos, we engage in a counting, which will remind all of us of the significance of our past and the very important significance of our future as well. This Pesach, I thought a lot about this because of all of the terrible and horrific tragedy that took place in our own community. I'd just like to digress just for a few minutes, only because it's so much on my mind. Not only what happened over Yom Tov, we had a terrible car accident, as many of us might know. I'm sure many of us know the family that was involved in that, where the Chassan and Kala passed away. That Levaya on Erev Yom Tov is something I wish nobody will ever have to attend again, but it was such a horrific scene. It was so shocking to see two caskets next to each other with so many young children who were in so much pain over the loss that they were experiencing. We had a young child, a 3-month-old child, who also passed away very suddenly. I'm very friendly with that family as well. Just yesterday, my wife and I were very involved with a family who's going through a horrific tragedy, just absolutely horrific. They have I can't even get into the details. They don't want people to know, but it's really such a terrible tragedy. We were out to almost 1 o'clock in the morning with this family. It's been a very painful experience over the last few weeks, and it just made me think a lot about when we have the opportunity to count Sfira, as Rav Soloveitchik said, it's a time for us to appreciate what time is worth to us. We keep accounting, and we take it for granted that we're going to be here tomorrow to actually continue the count and say that tomorrow is day 11 and the day after is day 12 and we're going to make it to Shavuos and have day 49 and celebrate the holiday. That is something that, unfortunately, we cannot assume any longer. It's something that we've seen is not as likely as we thought it may have been beforehand. And every year on Pesach, I'm reminded of the story that Rav Asher Weiss says over in all of his Pesach Shiurim that he gives. And it's something that I've heard over the last 15 years many, many times throughout his writings and his public talks. And it's something that has resonated with me, but certainly this year it made a very deep impact, a very deep impression. And that is, he always tells over the story about the young child who's sitting at the Seder with his grandfather. And in the middle of the Seder, the grandfather is relaying to his grandchild all of the incredible miracles of Kriyas Yamsuf and how amazing it was, the experience of the Jewish people walking through the dry land in the middle of the ocean. And the grandchild is very amazed by the story, but he turns to his grandfather and he says, "It all sounds wonderful, but I just don't fully understand why you're so taken by this miracle. After all, didn't God create the water? Didn't he create the sea? So why is it so amazing that he split the sea? What's the big excitement over this? This is something that is only natural. If he knows how to create it, he also knows how to split it." So the grandfather told him the following mashal in order to explain why he was so excited. And he said that there was once a sculptor, there was once an artist, who spent a lot of time trying to put together the most beautiful horse that he could. And after much great work, and he was a very seasoned artist, he designed something that was absolutely beautiful, and he asked his family, "How am I going to get the highest bidder to try to put in a bid on this beautiful piece of art?" So the family suggests that he goes to the city, and he drop off this beautiful piece of art right in the middle of Times Square, and tomorrow morning when everybody comes to work, when everybody comes to the office, obviously they're going to fight about it, and they're going to discuss who's going to pay a higher price, and then you'll stand there on the side and you will take advantage of the scene and you will finally get somebody to buy it. So he goes the next morning, early in the morning, he schleps it along with him on the train, and he puts it down right in the middle of Times Square, right in the middle of a busy place in the city, and he's waiting until rush hour, until people are going to mingle around in the city and they're going to start looking at this beautiful piece of art. And much to his dismay, he stands there on the side and not a single person stops to look at it. And he couldn't believe, how is it possible that nobody has the time to appreciate what I've created? Nobody has the patience to even look at it, to even notice what I've put here in the middle of the street. And he says to himself, you know, maybe it's just that they're rushing to get to work on time and nobody really has any extra moments to go and stop their busy schedules to look at this. So he decides he's going to wait until lunch hour. Maybe people are a little bit more relaxed. And once again, the same scene happens and nothing changes at all. And he decides, maybe I just have to wait until people are ready to go home for the evening, and then they'll be a little bit more relaxed, the working day is over, and they have a little bit more time. Maybe that's when they'll notice it. And once again, he sees that nobody stops to see his beautiful piece of art. So he's very down on himself, and he's very upset. And he comes home that night to discuss with his family what should he do. So he's depressed because he feels, maybe I'm just not a good artist, and no one's impressed with what I've put together. No one's impressed with what I've created. And his wife says to him, no, that's not the problem. The issue with what you made is you did such a great job that it looks real. So when people see a real horse, there's nothing to look at. It's not so exciting. So he says to her, what should I have done? I should have made a horse that wasn't perfect? Then I'm not a good artist. If I make one that looks too perfect, if I make one that looks too good, nobody bothers to look at it. So what do you suggest? So his wife suggests to him that perhaps he should go back the next morning, bring his piece of art to Times Square, to the same place, but slice it in half. And he should put one half of the horse on one side of the street and one half of the horse on the other side of the street. And when people see it, they'll have a double take. It looks real, but how could it be real? You cannot have a live horse that's split in half. And only then will they begin to appreciate the intricate details of the beautiful piece of work that you have created. So the grandfather told his grandson, yes, it's true. God is the one who created our entire cosmos, and he created the entire world, and the sea is amazing, and we should be amazed by it. But unfortunately, this is something that just looks too good, and it looks too perfect. And once in a while, God has to split the sea in order for us to gain an appreciation for what the sea always was beforehand. It's something that we were lacking. It's something that we were missing. And when a person makes something that is just too absolute, that is just too perfect and flawless, that is on the one hand beautiful, but on the other hand, it's something that takes away our ability to have a complete appreciation. And as we know, this is unfortunately the opportunity that we have when we suffer through loss, when we suffer through tragedy. It gives us the opportunity to stop life where it is and just to remind ourselves that life is sometimes a beautiful gift that we take for granted, and it's something that we don't fully appreciate or understand. I think every year when we read Parshas Bilam, there is no Parshas Bilam, when we read the story of Bilam, and You know, it's a startling story when an animal begins to talk and have a conversation with Bilam. I don't know how anyone is supposed to understand that. But every year when I read it, I say to myself, Bilam, how can you be so foolish? You have an animal that's talking to you and you just talk back to it like this is a normal conversation. Nothing phases him. Nothing seems to make him wonder that something here seems to be very unusual. And I always think to myself that he's such a fool. But then I think to myself, I'm also a pretty big fool. How many times has God sent the animal to talk to me? So not specifically the animal, but he sent many, many different forms of the animal to talk to me, and I just go on with life and ignore it, and I choose to ignore it. How many times have we turned on the news and we've watched that the Iron Dome has saved us from missile after missile and rocket after rocket? Is that not the same miracle as the animal talking to us? That is the most incredible miracle that we have been blessed with. And we just read the news item and we go on to the next one. We don't even bother to think about how incredible it is. And imagine if that thing malfunctioned and it didn't work, how many thousands of people would be killed every time. And we think about all of the things that go on, and no longer are we able to take anything for granted. You can go to a peaceful rally in Dallas, Texas, and you think that everything's going to be okay, and all of a sudden it turns into chaos and lawlessness and people are losing their lives. And you can have children going to school where they think they're safe, and all of a sudden some of them don't return home. And you can have a young couple who's going driving on the highway back from a date, and all of a sudden, the next thing they know, they're no longer here. So much so that their bodies couldn't even be identified. I mean, this is the life that we live, and this is the difficulty that we experience sometimes in the world. But it really gives us an opportunity, unfortunately, through these tragedies, to think about what time is actually worth to us. And as we count Sfira this year, we not only engage in the mitzvah itself and in the act of counting, but we also have the opportunity to just sit back and appreciate the fact that we have the ability to actually count, that we have the ability to say, today is day 10, and we hope that tomorrow we will make it to day 11, because it is no longer a given, and it is something that we need to take time to actually appreciate and to think about. The pasuk says, when, after 40 years in the Midbar, when Miriam passes away, it says that the Be'er, the water stream, was taken away, and they no longer had it. It only was Moshe Rabbeinu who had the ability to once again evoke that opportunity for the Jewish people to have the experience of having water come out of the rock once again. So the Torah says on that occasion, in Parshas Chukas, we're told, "Az Yashir Yisrael es Hashira Azos Alei Be'er." Now that the Be'er was brought back by Moshe Rabbeinu, now the Jewish people began to sing. And I beg the question, what happened all those 40 years? Miriam Hanaviyah was alive and she was providing the Jewish people with water. Nobody bothered to sing Shira. It was not an amazing miracle. You're traveling through the desert. Nobody else has water. Nobody else has any way of sustaining themselves. You see water flowing out of a rock and doesn't bother you to think about singing Shira all those years? And now all of a sudden the Be'er is restored by Moshe Rabbeinu. And now, you know, maybe we should thank God for this wonderful gift that he gave us of providing us with water. And the answer is, for 40 years, it was a given. We're going to have water, of course. Miriam's here. Why would we appreciate it? And for those of us who are blessed to still have parents, we take it for granted. We wake up every day, we have parents who are alive. Why would we think otherwise? Why would there be any other reality for us? Until it's no longer the reality. And then we start to say, you know, we should really thank God for all those wonderful years that we had and all those great experiences that we had the opportunity to share with those who we loved so much, with those who we were close with. But we don't think that way. And the Jewish people only had the opportunity of Az Yashir Moshe, of appreciating how much it meant to them that they had this incredible gift of water. They only had the opportunity to appreciate it after it was no longer there. And now Moshe Rabbeinu brings it back and they say, you know, all those years, we didn't even understand the great gift that we had. So much so that the Kli Yakar writes on Chumash, this is the reason why Miriam was taken away. Because people forgot that the experience that they were having in the Midbar, that the experience they were having with God Himself, was an incredible and overwhelming gift. And they forgot all about it, and God says, you know what, I have to take Miriam away. I remember I once read a story about Reb Shalom Shvadron. He was one of the great Magidim in Yerushalayim. So he said, on the occasion of the Petira, of the death of the Stipler was one of the great Tzaddikim in Bnei Brak. So people said, how could it be that God took away the life of the Stipler? I don't know what the question is. The Stipler lived to a ripe old age, so at some point, everybody is taken. So somebody asked Reb Shalom Shvadron, why did God take the Stipler's life away? Why didn't he allow him to continue to live on? He was a leader of the Jewish people. He was so important. His influence was extremely powerful. And Reb Shalom Shvadron said, you know why? Because people forgot that God is the one who runs the world. for the last 25, 30 years, anytime anyone had a problem, they went to the stipler to talk to him, and they said they want him to take care of it. They want him to daven for them. God wanted to remind them, if I take away the stipler, you're going to have to figure out how to deal with me. And unfortunately, that is the experience that we sometimes have to go through. And we don't have answers. We don't fully understand why. I was at the Shiva the other night with my father. We went to be Menachem Aval, and the family said to my father, New Rosh Hashiva, maybe you have some words of Nechama that you can share with us. And my father said, what can a person say? What can a person ever think of saying? How can I ever grant you a Nechama? What am I supposed to say? There is nothing to say. We don't have answers. We don't fully understand. But at the same time, we at least have the opportunity to use it as a moment of appreciating time and understanding how valuable time is and how fickle our lives are and how we are blessed to have the experience of spending time with our families and experiencing a Yom Tov and counting toward a Chag HaShavuos and understanding what that means for all of us. We all came together on Pesach night and we said, Shehechiyanu v'kiyumanu v'hegiyanu l'zman hazeh. To me, that's the most moving part of the Seder. When we have the opportunity to make a bracha Shehechiyanu, think about how many families didn't have the chance to say a Shehechiyanu with simcha and with excitement because of all that they're going through. And we have the opportunity to say Shehechiyanu v'kiyumanu v'hegiyanu l'zman hazeh. Just think about what that means for all of us. Think about how lucky we are and how blessed we always find ourselves being and how we hope that none of these tragedies ever befall any of us or our families, and they should not strike our community or any people that we are friendly with or close with. But at the same time, when they do happen, we have to think a little bit about how valuable time is. And therefore, I think, just as a way of introduction to what counting means to all of us and how important it is that we be involved in Sfiras HaOmer and how this time of year is really something that should make us think a little bit, certainly this year when we've heard about so much that has gone on since the beginning of counting of Sfira, we should just use it as a moment for introspection and for a little bit of appreciation and reflection for the lives that we live. So what I'd like to spend the next few minutes doing is just trying to understand some of the similarities and perhaps the differences with the various counting mitzvahs that we find throughout the Torah. As we said, the Torah seems to put a great emphasis on different countings. So we have, as we said, by sometimes Tuma and Tahara you have to count, sometimes by Avelis one has to count, Shiva Shloshim Yud Beis Chodesh. We find that Shavuos is something that we have to count up to. So we find in many different contexts that there's this idea of counting. You certainly can come in. There's someone by the door. You're welcome to join us. Someone wants to tell him. So we go, first of all, to Parshas Behar. And there we find the first counting mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of counting the years of Yovel. So there the Torah says, V'safarta lecha sheva shabbosos shanim. You should count for yourself 7 sets of 7 years. Sheva shanim sheva pa'amim. You have to count 7 year cycles, 7 times. V'hayulecha yimei sheva shabbosos hashanim teisha v'arba'im shana. And after you will count the 49 years, then you will celebrate the Yovel, the Jubilee year. Now the Rambam says, in the name of the Torah's Kohanim, which is one of the Midrashim, that this is not an individual obligation. This is not something that every Jew has an obligation to do. We don't have to have a sign on our refrigerator that says, this year, you know, everybody has signs on the fridge that say what day of Sfira we're up to, but we don't have any signs on our refrigerator that say what year of Yovel we're up to right now. So the Rambam says that is because we don't have a personal obligation to keep account of the Yovel. This is an obligation that is on the centralized Besdin, on the Besdin HaGadol. Somebody who's in charge, somebody of authority, has to keep track of which year in the Yovel cycle we are up to, but it's not an individual obligation. The Rashba writes in a tshuva that the reason why we assume it's not a personal obligation, it's rather a communal, is because the pasuk says, V'safarta lecha, belashon yachid. It is said in the singular conjugation, which means it was not meant for all of us collectively. There is one body that has the obligation to count on behalf of all of us, and they take care of our obligation. Why don't we see that when you go visit, let's say, Eretz Yisrael, nowhere do you find that even the Beis Din HaGadol, nowhere do you find that even the Rabbanut, or any reputable group of rabbis, or any communal leaders, nowhere do we find that they keep account of which year of Yovel we're up to? How come none of us have ever heard of this? What happened to the mitzvah of counting the years of Yovel? It is true that it is not a personal obligation for each and every one of us, but it's somebody's obligation. So what happened? How come none of us have ever seen a count that is kept? And the answer to that is based on a Gemara in Erechin Daf Lamed Beis, where the Gemara says that the Psukim tell us, what is one of the things that is supposed to happen when we experience a Yovel. So as many of us might know, the slaves have the opportunity to go free upon the Yovel. And when that happens, the Torah tells us, Ukrasem deror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveh. My father grew up in Philadelphia, so as a child I grew up in New York, but he always told us the stories about him visiting the Liberty Bell. And this is the pasuk that is stated on the Liberty Bell. Ukrasem deror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveh. You have to proclaim freedom for the entire land in the year of Yovel. That's what the Torah tells us. And from here the Gemara learns that it says, Ba'aretz l'chol yoshveh. You should proclaim freedom for the entire land, l'chol yoshveh, says the Gemara. The only time that Yovel is in effect is only when it is kol yoshveh aleha, when you have all of the Jewish people living in Eretz Yisrael. However, says the Gemara, in the days of Chizkiyahu HaMelech, when the Aseres HaShvatim were thrown out of the land and they went into Galus, they went into exile, so we assume that it is no longer kol yoshveh aleha. We don't have the Jewish people all living in the land of Israel anymore, and therefore Yovel is no longer applicable, because the terms that Yovel applies in no longer are relevant to us. That is what the Gemara tells us. Now, how could it ever be that you have every last Jew living in Eretz Yisrael? How could it be? Nobody went on a business trip? Let's say all the Jews are no longer in Galus, and now they're living in Eretz Yisrael. Just by the way, even when there's a Beis HaMikdash, it's not a given that every Jew is going to live in Eretz Yisrael. Some Jews are still going to live in other places. It's their choice. But let's say, for argument's sake, everybody is clamoring to live in Israel. But nope, what does it mean? You're going to have every Jew? So the Gemara says no. It means as long as you have Rov Yoshveh HaAleah, as long as you have most of the Jewish people living in Israel, that's when you have the obligation of counting the years of Yovel and observing all of the rules and regulations that pertain to the Yovel as well. However, if you don't have Rov Yoshveh HaAleah, if you don't have most of the Jews living in Israel at any given time, so the rules of Yovel no longer apply. I have been told, I don't exactly know, but I have been told that we are pretty close to the tipping point. We're pretty close to more than 50% of the Jews living in the land of Israel. Anybody know the surveys? I don't know. I asked last night at the shiur, and one of the women told me that they do believe that the surveys show that we're pretty close, or we're already there, that more than 50% of the Jews nowadays are living in the land of Israel, which is an incredible blessing. It's an unbelievable bracha, but not only that, it means it might be extremely relevant to reinstitute a mitzvah that has been gone for many, 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 many generations. So this is something that we have to keep in mind. So whether or not 50% of the Jews are living there or not, but there certainly was a mitzvah at some point in time that we have to keep track of the years of Yovel. And Tosis raises a question, what exactly is the nature of that mitzvah of counting the years of Yovel? What is the obligation? You have to actually keep a count? Is that really what it means? What? So you start Rosh Hashanah, because that's the beginning of the calendaric year. But what does it mean? Does it mean on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the Beis Din on behalf of all of us gets up and says, Ebracha, Asher Kedushanu, B'mitzvosav, Vitzivanu, Al, Sviras, Shnei HaYovel? They're supposed to make a bracha about counting the years of Yovel, and they should say, Hashanah, this year is, the same way we count Svira. They would say, this year is year 8, Shehem, Shmita Achas, Vishana Achas Ba'omer. Is that what they do? Is that really how it's supposed to be done? So in fact, the Ravid and some Rishonim believe, yes, the same way we have a mitzvah of Sviras Omer, and the same way we go out of our way to count and to explicitly state what year it is and what day it is, so too, that is what had to be done when Yovel was observed. The first day of the year, on Rosh Hashanah every year, the Beis Din gets up in Yerushalayim, and on behalf of all the Jews, they make a bracha, and they say, we are now fulfilling the mitzvah of Sviras Shnei HaYovel, of keeping the count of the Jubilee year, and this is where we're up to, this is how many years have passed, this is how many years we have left, and that's what they used to do. But many other Rishonim disagree, and they say that is not the nature of the mitzvah. The nature of the mitzvah is that in the abstract, somebody has to keep track of where we're up to. Nobody has to actually verbalize what year we're holding in, how far we've come, and how far we need to go. As long as there's a sign somewhere, as long as there's a system that someone's going to remember where we're up to, that would be sufficient, that would be good enough. Now, let's look at a second form of counting that we find, and let's try to figure out whether or not it's similar, or perhaps the nature of that mitzvah is a little bit different. The same discussion that we have by Yovel shows up here as well. The pasuk says, V'safra la shivas yamim, a woman who becomes temeya, a woman who now needs to go to the mikvah, has to first count 7 clean days, and only then does she have the ability to go to the mikvah. Now, as an aside, why is it that a woman who comes and says, I counted 7 clean days and I went to the mikvah, why would the woman be trusted? Let's say, for example, I'm not saying there's anything against women, I'm just saying, how do the rules work? Let's just break it down. How do the rules work? Let's say, for example, somebody comes into a Bezdin, somebody presents a case, we have a murder trial in front of us. God forbid, a murder trial is presented in front of the Bezdin. A witness walks in and says, I was there, and I saw this person murder the other person without a shadow of a doubt. I watched the whole thing, he almost killed me, and instead he decided to kill the person standing right next to me. There is no doubt about it, I watched it, there was no one else in the room, I was the only witness. Can we prosecute this person or not? Answer is no. Why? Because you need two witnesses in order to prosecute a person and give them the death penalty. Now I ask you, you walk into somebody's house and they tell you that the food is kosher. Why don't you need two witnesses to tell you that the food is kosher? Ever think about that? You walk into a restaurant, you have a mashgiach or a mashgicha. Right? In Israel, they started having women mashgichim, which is totally acceptable, I think. So, right, women have just as much trust as men. There's no reason why not. Now, by the way, just this has nothing to do, who's believed in a bezin has nothing to do with trust. Let's say Moshe Rabbeinu walks into the bezin and he says, I was there when somebody murdered somebody else, but I was the only one there. It's not that we don't trust Moshe Rabbeinu, but the rule is you need to have two witnesses that come in and present the case. That's it. So as much as you trust Moshe Rabbeinu, you still cannot accept his testimony by himself. So why is it that when I go to a restaurant, I can trust Moshe Rabbeinu who's sitting in the back of the kitchen being the mashgiach? The same way we don't trust Moshe Rabbeinu when he shows up in the Beis Din and tells us something, why should we trust him when he shows up and he tells us this piece of information? The answer is, we learn it from the laws of Nida, where the Torah states explicitly, V'safra la shivas yamim. The woman has the obligation to count 7 clean days. Does that mean that the woman has to have 2 witnesses every night to say that nothing went wrong? Of course not. The Torah says, V'safra la, she's able to keep a personal count by herself, and we as a community, as a family, as a husband, as a unit, we have a right to believe this woman and to take her word for it without asking any further questions. And from here, the Gemara learns that when it comes to certain areas of halacha, one person is enough to prove whatever it is that needs to be known. So when it comes to kashrus, all you need is one person to tell you that the food is kosher. You come to somebody's house to eat, you can assume that if the person is a religious person, you don't have to worry about whether or not their food is kosher. That does not mean that every Jew is obviously going to be trusted. It means that if a person is normally careful about kashrus, they have a right to be trusted. For example, I believe Rav Moshe Feinstein talks about in the Tshuva, I didn't have time to check it up, but I seem to remember from many, many years ago seeing it somewhere, that Rav Moshe Feinstein points out, I think there was a boy who became a Baal Tshuva, a Russian, he moved to Eretz Yisrael, and he was going back to visit his family back in Russia. They were not religious at all. He was religious, and he told his family that he was coming to visit them. They were so excited, and they said in his honor they were going to be very careful about the laws of kashrus. And he wanted to know, does he have a right, as much as he loves his parents, does he have a right to eat in their home? Does he have a right to really trust that his parents are going to keep to the laws of kashrus? Well, after all, it's true. One Jew has a right to say that she kept a count of 7 days and went to the mikveh. One Jew has a right to say that I was a careful mashgiach, and I sat in the back of the kitchen, and I made sure that everything is kosher in the restaurant. We have a right to believe them. And one Jew should have the right to say that I'm serving my child kosher food. But if that person knows nothing about the laws of kashrus and is never careful about the laws of kashrus, they really don't have a right to be trusted. A number of years ago, I don't know if we all remember the story from the Mansi Butcher. Remember that story? So it was a horrible story, and he obviously cannot be trusted with kashrus, correct? So I remember I got an email. It wasn't directed to me. They wanted me to present it to my father that this person ultimately moved to Eretz Yisrael. Apparently he got remarried. I don't know the story. I'm not interested in the details. But he wanted to rebuild his life, and he was inviting seminary girls over to his house and yeshiva boys to his house to eat Shabbos all the time. Nobody really knew who he was, and people thought he was a very nice man, inviting people into his home all the time. The food obviously was good enough that they wanted to come back. And one of his neighbors found out at some point who he was and what his history was and what the story with him was. And they had a question that they wanted me to ask my father. Do we need to warn the seminaries and the yeshivas that their children are going to this person's house and he might not be serving them kosher food? After all, he has a history of serving non-kosher food on a much bigger scale. So does that person lose their ability to now be trusted for this area of halacha? This is a very important question. So obviously, As much as we would say that a Jew, the baseline understanding is that a Jew has the right to be trusted when they tell us certain facts of life, when they tell us that certain things were done, unless they have lost their trust for some reason, then obviously they can no longer be trusted. So here the Torah says that a woman is supposed to keep count, v'safra la shivas yamim. The woman is supposed to keep a count 7 days, and then ultimately she is able to go to the mikvah. Well, what exactly does that mean that she keeps a count? Does a woman every night of the Shiva Nikiyim have to sit down and make a bracha, asher kedishanu, b'mitzvosav, v'tzivanu, al sviras Shiva Nikiyim, halayla yom shnayim, b'shavua, whatever it is you're going to say? Is that the way it's supposed to go? So as we all know, that is not what's done. But the question is, why? Why is that any different than sviras ha'omer? After all, Torah says by sviras ha'omer, usvartem lachem. Torah says over here by Shiva Nikiyim, v'safralah. So why should there be any distinction? Why should there be a difference? The same way we have an obligation to count, to verbalize, and to say a bracha on it by Sfiras HaOmer, that should be no different than the obligation that we should find when a woman is counting the 7 days. So Tosis writes in Maseches Ksubos, v'im tomar, amayein mivarecha zava al Sfiras. So why doesn't a woman have to actually make a bracha when she's counting the 7 days? Kimosha mivarchem al Sfiras HaOmer. The same way she counts by Sviras HaOmer leading up to Shavuos, why should there be any distinction? Why should there be any difference? After all, Tosfos says, we find the same terminology here, v'safra la, as we find over there, usvartem lachem. So Tosfos gives a very difficult answer, which we'll get back to a little bit later. V'yesh lomar de'ein mevarchem ela biyovel. The only time we have to make a bracha is when we're keeping the count of the years of Yovel. Tosfos is of the opinion that you have to count with a bracha once a year. The Beis Din gets up and they make a bracha on behalf of the Jewish people. Why? Because he says, Shela Olam Yuchal Limnos Keseder. Because you have the ability to count every year and nothing can get in your way. The same way by Sviras HaOmer. We're going to count Sviras HaOmer because in a normal year we have the ability to count every night and make it all the way to Shavuos. So therefore we keep a count. However, he says, when it comes to counting the 7 days of Yemei Tahara, he says, Zava Imtira Tistar, at any moment, something can go wrong. And if on day four something goes wrong, you have to start all over again. So what happened to all those 4 days? You were going every night making a bracha. It turns out to be a bracha levatala. So therefore he says, this is the reason why no bracha is recited by counting the 7 days before a person goes into the mikvah. Again, we'll get back to that point a little bit later and whether or not it is accepted, whether or not it is so simple. But just, we should be aware that the various countings that we find in Chumash don't always seem to follow a uniform pattern. Not always is the nature of the counting the same, and not always do we fulfill the mitzvah of counting in the same way either. Now we come finally to the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer that we have the opportunity to fulfill at this time of year as well. The major Rishonim had a big dispute about what the nature of the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer actually is. Almost all of the Rishonim believe that the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer is we have 49 different mitzvos at this time of year. Day 1 is a separate mitzvah, and day 2 is a separate mitzvah, and day 3 is a separate mitzvah, and every night is a separate mitzvah. This is the reason why every night we make a separate bracha. This is why every night we make a separate count, because every night is a separate mitzvah. However, the Bahag, who is one of the Gaonim, the Baal Halachas Gedolos, was of the opinion that Sfiras HaOmer is just one long mitzvah that takes 49 days to fulfill. It has 49 different components. It is one big mitzvah that one comes to the completion at the end of the day of Sfiras HaOmer, at the day 49. Once you've made it to 49, now retroactively you have fulfilled everything. What practically would be the difference between his opinion that this is all one big mitzvah and the overwhelming majority of the Rishonim that this is all 49 different mitzvahs every night of the week? What is the difference? A practical difference would be, let's say somebody knows from the outset that they're going to have a surgery at some point during Sfira and they're not going to be able to have a continuum. They're not going to be able to count every night. They know from the beginning. So look, mistakes happen all the time. Unfortunately, we forget every so often. But let's say from the outset, one knows that something is scheduled that will prevent them from counting one night of Sfira. Well, according to the Bahag's opinion, you shouldn't even start. You shouldn't even start because you're not going to be able to complete it. And every night you count Sfira with a bracha because the assumption is that you're going to make it till the end. And therefore the Bahag says, if you know from the outset that that's not going to happen, this is something one needs to think about, whether or not they are able to even begin. I know my father says every year after Pesach, when he talks about Sviras Omer, he says the amazing story about the NCSY girl, that my father used to go every year to the December 25th get-together that they have for all the NCSY kids, the public school kids all over the country. And one year they had asked him to speak about the laws of brachos, the basic laws of Hilchos Brachos. So I've never heard my father talk basic about anything, but I guess he did. So he was just talking about a number of issues, and he said he noticed in the crowd there was a girl who he had met many, many times before on some other retreats that they had. And this girl was a non-Jewish girl who was very, very interested in converting, but she was in high school. So every year when she came to the retreat, the counselors would tell her, it's a very nice thing that you want to convert, and we understand that you're very fully committed, but it's not such a wise idea to do it before you're self-sustaining, before you can take care of your own finances, and before you can live in your own kosher kitchen. How are you going to convert, and then you're going to go back to your parents' non-kosher house? How's that going to work? So they were convincing her that she should wait off on the idea until she becomes a little bit older. So my father noticed that she was there at his session. So he said, obviously this goes without saying that a bracha is only relevant to somebody who is a Jew. If somebody is not a Jew, how can you say, Asher kedushanu b'mitzvosav v'tzivanu? How can you say, God instructed me to do it? God did not instruct you to do it. Only once a person converts, can they make a bracha, Asher kedushanu b'mitzvosav v'tzivanu. So the girl came over to him right after his session, and she said she was very upset that all this time she's been making the bracha, so now you're taking away from me the opportunity to even make a bracha. I'm upset about it. I want to convert this evening. I want to convert now. So they tried to convince her out of it. They tried to discuss it with her. Anyway, they realized they're not getting anywhere, so they set a date for the conversion. And it was clear that the girl knew, she was very knowledgeable, and she knew everything that one has to know before converting. So my father got together the Beis Din, and the general practice is that before a candidate for conversion goes into the mikveh, so, and no, don't worry, the men don't watch the person go into the mikveh, but before a candidate for conversion actually converts, so we have the last chance to ask them, are you sure you have any questions for us before you want to convert? Are you sure you really want to sign up to this? Do you understand what it entails? So my father told the rabbis that came with him, this girl, I've known her for years, there's nothing to be concerned about. You don't have to ask her anything. She knows everything there is to know. Just don't give her a hard time. Don't start going through the regular procedure that we have. Just for her, it's fine. So one of the other rabbis who was with him was very nervous, and he said, what do you mean? But the procedure is the procedure. This is what we have to do. This is what we always do. My father said, I'm telling you, I know this girl for years. Just leave it alone. Just trust her. Don't make her nervous. Just let her go. Anyway, this rabbi wouldn't hear it, so he starts asking her, do you believe in God? She says, yes, of course I believe in God. Do you believe in Kashrus? She said, should I hold by the OU or the Star K or the Chaf K? She started asking them all these questions. So finally they realize who they're dealing with. And my father says, okay, just let her go. Just let her go. Leave her alone. So the rabbi asks her, do you have any questions for us before you convert? Is there anything that's bothering you? Anything you're not sure about? So she says, yes, I do have a question. He says, what's the problem? So the woman says, we're in the middle of Svira now. It's after Pesach. Now, I've been counting all the days until now without a bracha because Rabbi Schechter said I can't say a bracha. I'd like to know tonight, do I have the right to start counting with a bracha because I missed the first half? My father said to the other rabbi, this woman is asking such a question. Do we think we can accept her as a convert? So yes, these kinds of questions actually happen. Let's say a bar mitzvah boy who becomes bar mitzvah halfway through the sfira, or a girl who only becomes obligated halfway through the sfira. Do they have a right to start counting with a bracha if officially they missed the first half? All of these are very relevant applications of this disagreement. Where we started with the story was that almost all of the Rishonim believe that every night of sfira is a separate mitzvah. The Bahag is of the opinion that all the 49 days are considered one long mitzvah that has many different components to it. So that is the major discussion. The Shulchan Aruch adopts the opinion of both. And the Shulchan Aruch says, out of respect to the opinion of the Bahag, because the Bahag for some reason was considered to be a very important figure that we need to always reckon with, even if we don't accept his opinion, even if he's against everybody else, we try as best as we can to show our respect for his opinion. There are many svarim that write that the Bahag's opinion was called Dvarav Divrei Kabbalah. Whatever he said was somehow sent from heaven, and therefore we expect that his words are always going to be in some way dealt with. So here the Shulchan Aruch adopts the compromise opinion, and the Shulchan Aruch says, really we believe that the accepted opinion should be that every night of Sviras Omer is a separate mitzvah. And therefore, if a person forgets to count one night, they should just be able to continue counting with a bracha for the subsequent evenings, because every night is a separate story. However, because the Bahag was of the descending opinion, out of respect to the Bahag, we continue the count without making a bracha on the subsequent days. Now, sometimes people don't remember that. They think once you're out, you're out. That's not correct. Once you're out, you're not out. Once you're out and you've forgotten to count an evening, you should continue to count without a bracha, simply out of respect to the Bahag's opinion. Now, I've discussed with my father on many occasions, and he agreed with me, that I don't know about you, but the people that I'm close with, who have unfortunately forgotten every so often one night of Sfira, again, if you don't go to shul for Ma'ariv, it's very easy to forget. It's very easy not to remember, or if you're busy in the house or at work or with kids or whatever it might be, so you don't always remember to count Sfira. So people forget to count, and then they continue without a bracha. And I've told my father that I feel once you knock the bracha out, people no longer think it's an obligation at all. Am I correct? I've found that sometimes when people are out of the bracha, they think they're out entirely, and they don't count at all. And I think there's room to argue that, I believe I once saw this maybe in the Aruch HaShulchan, I can't remember where, but I believe that there's room to argue that if it's going to make a person forget to count at all, you should just continue to count with a bracha. Because really, strictly speaking, we believe that all the other Rishonim are right, and every night is a separate mitzvah. So this is the compromise opinion that we adopt in Shulchan Aruch, that if one forgets an evening, they should continue to count without a bracha. But if it's going to make a person forget entirely, then you should just go back and do what's really supposed to be done and count with a bracha. Yes? Remember, I saw a couple of years ago that Rav Meir Shapiro was a great, story about Rav Meir Shapiro. Rav Meir Shapiro was such a great giant of a man, and he accomplished so much, and you'll be surprised that he only lived, I think, until the age of 45 or 46, something like that. He died at a very young age, but he accomplished such incredible things in his life. He was the one who initiated the Daf Yomi. He was the one who built Yeshivas Chachmei Lublin, which was the first yeshiva of its kind. He was a really amazing person. So Rav Meir Shapiro said over the story that he was once visiting a person during Sfira, and he came into this person's house, and he was trying to ask him for a contribution to the yeshiva. So the person was trying to show Rav Meir Shapiro what a pious Jew he is. So he said, you know, in preparation for Shavuos, I do something very special in my house. So he said, what is it? What do you do? So he said that every night of Sfiras Omer, I make sure to eat dairy food, because we know the practices on Shavuos, you're supposed to eat dairy. He said, every night, according to how many nights of Sfira it is, that's how many dairy items I eat. So I don't know, he had, 49th day of Sfira, I guess he had 49 pancakes, I don't know. But he said, this is what I do every night in order to prepare myself for Shavuos. So Rav Meir Shapiro asked him as a joke, and the guy was very proud of this. So he asked him as a joke, so what happens if you forget one night? What do you do? So he says, I eat the next night without making a bracha. So Rav Meir Shapiro said, obviously this is an apocryphal story, but he said that it comes from a very pure source. So as we mentioned, we have many different cases in halacha where we find an obligation to count. We spoke about the count that we have to keep for Yovel. We spoke about the count that we have to keep for Sfiras Omer. And the count that we have to keep as well when it comes to Yimei Tahara and being able to go to the mikvah. Now the Radvaz asks a question in his tshuva. The Radvaz was one of the great Gedolim that lived in the 1400s. He was born in Spain. He later on became the Rav in Cairo. So the Radvaz asked the question, how do we put all these together? Are they all the same? Tosus, as we mentioned before, says the reason why a woman doesn't recite a bracha when she counts the 7 days leading up to going to the mikveh is because Shema Tira Vitister. Maybe something's going to go wrong, and then she's going to invalidate the count, and she'll have to start all over again, and therefore, why should she make a bracha in the first place? That's what Tosus writes. Is that really something that we should accept? Is that really true? Say, for example, says the Radvaz, say, for example, we know on a public fast day, one of the things that we're supposed to mention in Shemona Esrei is Anenu. Now the Rishonim have a major discussion. In which tefillah do you recite Anenu? Only in Mincha. Why don't we recite it in Shacharis? In case you're going to break your fast. Why do you recite it in Mincha? Because we assume once you've made it to Mincha time, we assume you're going to be able to be strong enough to finish it off. But you don't do it in the morning because you say in the tefillah, B'yom Tzom Taniseinu, God, please answer me because today is my day of mourning. Today is my day of fasting. What do you mean? You're lying to God? It might not turn out to be that way. So the question is, half of the Rishonim say, there's no problem. Right now, when I'm davening Shacharis, I have plans. My intention is that I'm going to finish off the day. So that's not called lying to God. That's not called saying something that's not true. And this is a major discussion. Right now, I'm doing what I think is the right thing to do. So why shouldn't I just look at the context of what I'm doing right now and not worry about what's going to happen later? And the same question is here. A woman every night of counting the 7 days leading up to the mikveh. What are you going to say? Maybe something's going to go wrong? Maybe not. Right now, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. The Torah instructs me that I'm supposed to count, and this is supposed to be my mitzvah. Why don't I make a bracha? That is the major question that the Radvaz tries to deal with. Take for another example. The Chasam Sofer discusses the case about, we spoke before about gerus, about conversion. So not only do adults convert, sometimes every once in a while we have a child who converts as well. How can you convert a child? How can you convert a child? You need a person to accept upon themselves that they want to really be a Jew, that they really have an interest in following all the rules. How can we have somebody who's a child, who doesn't even have a mature mind yet, accept to be a convert? What does that mean? So the answer is we have an institution of a ger katan. So unfortunately, there are some families that cannot conceive, that cannot have their own children, and they adopt. And they adopt sometimes a non-Jewish child. Most times we have religious families that adopt a non-Jewish child. That non-Jewish child, they don't want to raise the non-Jew to be a non-Jew. They want to convert the child, but very often they adopt the child at a month old. So how are you going to convert the kid? So there's a whole process that we go through, but before we do the conversion, we make a bracha, right? Al tefilas ager. Now the Chasam Sofer raises the following issue. He says the Gemara tells us, and the Shulchan Aruch writes this, lahalacha, that when you have a child who converts in infancy, before he is a mature adult, he or she is a mature adult, so we assume at the first time that they are informed, when they become an adult, that they were converted as children, they have a right to decide whether or not they're happy with it, whether or not they want to stay with the conversion, or whether or not they want to go back to the old life. We have every couple of years, it happens in every high school, in every Jewish high school, that you have a child who was converted, the parents never told them, at 17, 18 years old, they're doing some kind of report, and they're trying to look back at the lineage, and they find out that they were converted. The parents tell them the truth. And it obviously throws the child into a whole psychological tizzy. We won't get into that, but whoever deals with that, the question always is, the child now says, I was converted, I'm not interested in this, this is a pain in the neck. And the question is, the child really has the right to make such a choice, to make such a decision. I had a guy who was in high school with me in Eretz Yisrael. In 11th grade, he found out that he was not Jewish. He was adopted. He's a Russian. And his parents let him know that he was not Jewish at all. And he decided, okay, I'm done with this. And he was out. And this happens every couple of years. It's a very difficult circumstance when it does happen. But says the Chasam Sofer, when we convert a child, we make a bracha. Would you say that a bracha should not be recited because maybe 15 years down the line, he's going to find out that he's a convert and he's going to say, I didn't want this. And it's going to turn out in retrospect that the bracha that we made 15 years ago was a bracha levatala? Or do you say, no, right now, we do what we have to do, says the Chasam Sofer. Are we going to say that that child throughout his infancy, throughout his childhood, is never allowed to touch a bottle of wine? Because maybe it's going to turn out that he's not Jewish. And then we're going to have to go back and say all the wine has to be spilled out because a non-Jew got in contact with our wine. Says the Chasam Sofer, you can't live like that. Right now we make a bracha, because right now we're doing what we are instructed to do. If it turns out later on that something might change, and that it turns out that he really was not a convert at the time, and we really were not doing anything of substance or significance, says the Chasam Sofer, then so be it. But right now we're doing what we're supposed to do. Another example, the Ritva writes, let's say a person washes their hands for Netilas Yadayim, because I'm about to eat bread. Then I come to the table and I see there's no bread. It turns out it was a cracker. I thought it was bread. Really, it was the Gebrucks crackers that look like bread, whatever it was. And it turns out I didn't have to wash on them. So do you say that I made a bracha lebatala? Says the Ritva, no. Why? Because at the time, I had in mind to go and wash for a sandwich and to eat the sandwich. This is what I was supposed to do. This was my mitzvah. Now it turns out that what I did before was for no reason. But at the time that I did it, I had no problem. Take for another example, the Trumas HaDeshen writes, this is quoted in the Ramallah Halacha, Erev Chanukah. I know we're skipping around a lot of different places, but it's going to be your job to put it all together and think about how all these actually jive or perhaps don't. So let's say the Trumas HaDeshen writes in Ilchas Chanukah, you light Chanukah candles on Erev Yamtif. I'm sorry, on Erev Shabbos. You light them much earlier than the time that you're allowed to. Why? Because you can't light on Friday night. Now what happens if the candles go out? So I made a bracha, Asher Kedushanim, it says, V'tzivanu lahadik nar shel Chanukah. It's not even Chanukah. Let's say Chanukah starts Friday night. I made a bracha, it's not even Chanukah yet. They go out before Chanukah starts. says the Trumas Hadesh, and it turns out your bracha was a bracha levatela, maybe on Erev Shabbos we shouldn't make a bracha, because who knows what's going to happen? Says the Trumas Hadesh, and of course not. Why? Because right now I'm doing the mitzvah the way I was instructed to do so. And even though later on it might turn out that something is going to change, so let it be that it will change. But I did what I was supposed to do, and I cannot be held accountable for something that's going to happen later. And the question is, why would we assume that keeping the count of Shiva Nikiyim should be any different? If all over the place we find that the halacha dictates, you make a bracha if right in front of you now you think and you believe with honesty that you have a mitzvah that you're supposed to be performing. Why would it be different when a woman on the 7 nights before going to the mikvah keeps the count 7 days? Why would you assume that that should be any different? Shouldn't it be the same that right now I am doing a mitzvah that I'm instructed to do, and if something happens later on that was out of my control, so it's not my problem? So this is a very interesting area of halacha to think about. How do you put all of those different ideas together and figure out where we draw the line? When would we say that it's acceptable to make a bracha because right now this is what I see in front of me and right now this is what I'm obligated to do? And on which occasions do we say that perhaps a bracha should be left out because it might lead to a bracha levatela? Mirtz Hashem next week.